Larry. Fucking Larry.
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 Larry. Larry, get into bed now.
Timing really is everything, and I do mean everything. Think of all the people that were shredded by the media meat grinder whose misdeeds and scandals might have gone unnoticed had they simply waited for the Wuhan flu. Ooh, did I just call a virus by the non-PC name? But it's amazing how a matter of weeks or days or hours or even minutes can alter the trajectory of your life forever. I had such an event of critical timing myself. I didn't know it at the time. We rarely do. Rear view mirror views can be kind of blurry until you reach a certain distance. But something I did, just a few moments later than I had planned, changed the course of my life in incalculable ways. And I'll circle back to that in a little bit. Think about all the stupid stories that this nation was obsessing over. And now, would anybody give a row of rat shit about, say, Jussie Smollett? Huh? Some failing actor trying to finagle a raise by staging a racist attack? And how about those other thespians, Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughman? You know, I had to look up both their names. I'd already forgotten them. And their college bribery affairs. Those administrators they bribed better have banked all their dirty money, because the Rona has kind of blown the lid off their game. All over the country, hell, the world probably, kids who were students in bricks and mortar learning institutions are getting pretty much the same education online. So who needs a campus? Who needs a lecture hall? Who needs to pay the insane tuition to pay the insane salaries of all those self-styled pedagogues? When this virus thing starts to evaporate, a lot of professors are going to be trading in those snappy tweed jackets with the elbow patches for green Starbucks or orange Home Depot aprons. That's definitely one of the upsides of this pandemic. Most college is bullshit. Ivy League college might be bullshit with whipped cream and a cherry. I've known quite a few guys with Harvard and Yale degrees, and some were really, really smart, and some are not. Some had daddies rich enough to build the school a gym or a pool or a lab or hang a fresh wing in a library, and so those guys managed to slide through without breaking a sweat. But the guys I know told me their Ivy educations probably were kind of average. The only real advantage it gave them was the social connections with wealthy A-list families who could open doors for them after graduation. But Harvard recently found itself in the news, the feds spraying trillions of stimulus dollars with a fire hose, which, by the way, is our money, yours and ours. They had sent a check to Harvard for $8.5 million. And Harvard, which has an endowment of nearly $41 billion, that's with a B, was intent on hanging on to that $8.5 million undeserved gift until the restaurant chain Shake Shack, in an unprecedented display of honesty, said, Hey, U.S. government, you sent us a fat check, but we're really not a small business and we don't need it, so we're sending the money back. Only because of Shake Shack was Harvard shamed into returning their undeserved financial aid. To give you a sense of what $41 billion endowment means, there are only 5 corporations in the country that have hoarded more cash than Harvard University. Those would be Apple, Microsoft, Alphabet, Google, Pfizer, and Cisco. That means that Harvard, the school, is richer than 495 out of the Fortune 500 corporations, including names like Walmart, Exxon, AT&T, General Motors, and so on. Looks like education does pay, especially if you're selling it. But I digress. The list goes on and on, of those who could and would have skated on scandal and convictions if only they had timed their scandal to coincide with this all-consuming pandemic. I mean, let's look back at the past year, the big stories of 2019. Do we give a shit about rapper 6ix9ine's legal woes now? Or that the owner of the Patriots was charged with paying a hooker? Ooh, nobody ever did that before, huh? Or that Johnny Depp was in some perfume ad that allegedly culturally appropriated something from some group. Harvey Weinstein had all but vanished until it was announced that he had the Rona. Then he was news again. I guess he recovered, but I don't recall seeing any coverage about that. And what about the big kahuna scandal last year? Jeffrey Epstein suicide. The virus sure knocked his cadaver off the front pages. Had Epstein wound up dead last month instead of last August, would we have even known about it? I guarantee you, there are any number of celebutards trying to figure out a way to get coronavirus, the mild, sort of asymptomatic strain of coronavirus, so their faces get exposure. Guaranteed, that notion is a thought balloon over many, many Hollywood heads. Probably some political parasites as well. Suddenly, America doesn't care very much about celebrities and their peccadilloes, not when our health and livelihoods are threatened. You have to wonder what other felonious and gossip-worthy scandals are not being reported now. Maybe this is a great time to settle some scores or plan a heist or do something outrageous you've always wanted to do. Nobody would give a shit. A lot of guys are street racing because the roadways are kind of empty and it seems fewer cops are patrolling them. I'll bet you some world record drug deals are going down. But scandals are not. It seems that when we do things can be as important as what things we do. And sometimes the slightest delay or rush can change the path of your life. And you never realize it until well after the decisive moment. It needn't be something as dramatic as having a second cup of coffee that makes you miss a plane that subsequently crashes. It might be simply waiting to make a phone call or a text, which is something I do a lot. I've never been capricious. I tend to think things through, probably too much. But I once delayed returning a call for maybe 5 minutes, and that brief interval changed my life more than any decision I ever consciously made. When I lived in New York, I lucked into this fantastic rental house that was owned by a wealthy couple from Florida. I lived there for several years. In the warm months, it was great. The beach was private, residents only, and the town, they had a foolproof way to discourage invaders. No street parking, none, not even for residents. So that eliminated the possibility of counterfeit windshield stickers or fake rearview hang tags. If there was a car parked on the street, it disappeared fast. The town had some tow company on retainer that moved like lightning, and word got around. Also, to get onto the beach in the summer, you had to wear a metal numbered badge that kept away interlopers who might try to cycle or hike in. So it was about as private a beach as you could get without owning the sand. My front yard was the crashing Atlantic, which I still much prefer to the Pacific. In the summer in the Northeast, the Atlantic really warms up thanks to the jet stream. In the winter, it gets frigid, but so what? The Pacific never really gets as warm as the Atlantic does in summer. And in the winter, you need a wetsuit in the Pacific, and you'll still freeze your ass off. The Atlantic is also saltier, so the swimming is better. You're more buoyant. In fact, as visually stunning as California beaches are, they're far better for looking rather than enjoying. Kelp beds that go on for acres can fuck up the swimming, even drown you if you're not careful. Then there's the rocks. The West Coast is much rockier than the East, so you really have to know where you're swimming or you can break your face. And then there are the offshore oil wells, dozens of them. And those fuckers leak. You spend a day on a Southern California beach and odds are you are going home with a patch of sticky black oil gunk on the soles of your feet, which can only be removed with some refined petroleum product, gasoline or lighter fluid. It's almost diabolical. Then if you're close enough to the source oil fields, they stink. There's a beach called Summerland up near Santa Barbara. 100 years ago, they were pumping millions of barrels of crude out of there. The beach was covered with hideous derricks. Sometime in the 1960s, they cleaned the derricks out, but a hell of a lot of those wells are still leaking. The oil company actually plugged the wells with debris, like mattresses and old planking. And so there are still omnipresent oil slicks and black sand, and the stench can be nauseating if you're downwind. But nobody seems to give a fuck. California beaches, I guess, are a lot like Hollywood. They look great, but it's just an illusion. Beaches in New York and New Jersey are way better for swimming. Even the sand is finer and cleaner. So I rented this kick-ass house, and it was amazing. Right on the beach for a silly low rent. There was a jetty close by, and I got to know exactly where a can't-miss fishing hole was. I'd go out there any time with a line baited with a hunk of frozen squid and reel in my dinner. Many times the fish was still wriggling when I started to fillet it. That's how short the trip was from sea to stove. Living in a place like that, I never lacked for company. And if I threw a party, I usually wound up with more guests than were on the invitation list. Late one fall, I threw this party. It was November 21st. I still recall the date for a specific reason, which I'll get to. The party started off on a sunny afternoon, but as dusk fell, a thick fog rolled in. We were inside in front of the fire, cocktailing it up before dinner, when I heard a local character doing his thing. The dude was a bagpiper, and whenever things got gray and misty, he'd climb into his kilt, grab his pipes, and serenade the empty beach. Everyone heard him and looked at me like, what the fuck? So I charged outside and invited him to the party. Soon my house had the ambiance of the Scottish moors, and of course, we all had many drinks between his songs. After a while, he left, and we continued to drink and eat, and somewhere in the wee small hours, somebody suggested a swim. Oh, the folly of liquor-fueled ideas. We all bolted to the waves and dove in, dressed, except the women. They were wise enough to pass on the swim. Only the men could see the allure of hypothermia. The water was frigid, somewhere in the 40s, and rough. The waves were running 6 feet or better. Well, the next day, we were congratulating ourselves on setting a new late-season record for an ocean swim, November 21. But all the backslapping ceased when one of my friends discovered his keys were in Davy Jones' locker, along with another guy's wallet. Oh, the abuse they got from their women over that. But living in that house was fantastic, and I fell in love with the town. There was zero crime. The people were friendly. The only drawback was winter. But still, I loved it. After several years of scrimping and saving, I had put aside enough for a down payment on a house there. As much as I liked my rental, I wanted to invest in a place of my own. So I started shopping. A friend of mine was a realtor, and when something came on the market that I could afford, he told me first, and I liked it. It wasn't right on the beach like the rental, but it was a very short walk. It was a nice little house in decent shape, a terrific starter. I told my pal I'd think it over and call him in the morning. The next day, I worked out all the budgeting one more time to make sure I could swing the deal without starving. And I reached for the phone to make an offer. For some reason, I stalled. Thought I'd just step outside for a couple minutes, look at the ocean, and then make the call. I went back inside and dialed my friend, told him I'd take the house. He was oddly silent, and he stammered and told me he had taken an offer from another buyer mere moments ago. Well, I was irked, but only at myself. He had given me first crack. Had I not stalled, but made the call when I should have, he'd have been making apologies to some other would-be buyer. I was bummed. Affordable houses rarely came available in that town. But, as much as I loved the beach, I also had a bellyful of New York City, and the shitty commute by car, railroad, and subway to my office every day. If everything ran like clockwork, and it never did, it was a 90-minute haul, minimum, 3 hours a day. The drive to the railroad train was okay. I had my big-ass Mercury and listened to I, Mr. Stern. And the Long Island Railroad was also okay. Rare were the times I didn't find a seat. But that fucking subway uptown from Penn Station, oh, that sucked. Always. Always packed, always airless, always depressing, sometimes dangerous. The New York subways are shit. By this time in my life, I had passed on two previous job offers in L.A., and I was kind of pissed at myself, and still had a powerful desire to move out here. Incredibly, a few days after missing out on that house purchase, an opportunity came up in L.A., and I took it. Why not? There was very little holding me in the East. If it didn't work out, I could always come back, and the only casualty of a bad decision would be myself. But had I been in the process of buying that house, I would not even have considered the job in L.A. I'd have felt anchored to a beach home on Long Island. I'd have felt like I had roots. Had I made that call to my realtor buddy a few minutes earlier, how different would my life have been and still be? When I lived in New York, I was often in the World Trade Towers. One client in particular was very fond of breakfast meetings at the top floor restaurant Windows on the World. Might I have been in one of those meetings on 9/11? Had I made that call earlier, I would not have met my wife. I'd now be looking across the dinner table at a different woman, different kids, or maybe none at all. I'm kind of picky. Even the dog would be different. My kids pick Moose, not me. Now I see news of New York, and it looks like a living hell in the midst of this pandemic with bodies piled up like cordwood. Oddly, that was always my biggest complaint about New York, the crowding, the density, the feeling that you could barely breathe. Oh, L.A. has plenty of warts, but I've never felt claustrophobic here, not even for a second. And aside from a very few locations downtown, you can always see plenty of sky here. It's open. And if you want to get the hell away from people, you can be in some very rugged mountains in no time. Or that beach, with the killer kelp beds and oil slicks and lots of rocks to smash your face on. No place is perfect. When I do some things now, even small things, I sometimes wonder if, as I'm doing them, how my life might take an unexpected turn. Timing really is everything. And thank you for your time, for hanging with me once again. It's always great to be with you. I just posted a new bonus episode. It's available at patreon.com/thatlarryshow. At all belt levels instead of the usual brown belt level, you can call it the pandemic discount. In it, you'll find ridiculously easy ways to motivate yourself, because we're all stuck in this stupid lockdown, and there are things we can and should be doing to make our lives better, but oh, the distractions, huh? Well, this episode will tell you how to get to achieve your goals quarantine or not, you will motivate. There are 34 other bonus episodes at Patreon. Stop by and have a look. Write to me at thatlarryshow@gmail.com. If you're grappling with a dilemma, we've got a deep bench of senseis who can help you wrestle it to the mat. Stop by the show page for the full archive of over 250 regular episodes, and don't forget to click a subscribe button. Google, Apple, whatever you prefer. It costs bupkis, but that way you never miss an episode. I'll see you next Tuesday or thereabouts, and until that time, take no shit.